Throughout the 1970s, the TLA Cinema on South and 4th Streets has shown repertory and cult films ranging from American musical comedies to French New Wave cinema to the Rocky Horror Show. A few months ago, it looked pretty certain that the theater was going to close. Because Stephen Starr, the owner of Starr's, the club on 2nd and Bainbridge, had eyes to use the buy the theater and convert it into a nightclub, when we initially asked Al Malmfeldt, director of the TLA, to speak with us on Fresh Air today, we were thinking that this would be somewhere between a retrospective and a eulogy for the TLA. But now the closing of the TLA is less imminent. You probably know that members of the South Street community have been trying to prevent the demise of the TLA by petitioning against granting a liquor license for the proposed club, and also objecting to the noise that a club might create. There's currently a legal battle also pending between the TLA and the owners of the property. But right now, the TLA is open, and there's no definite plans for its closing. Al Malmfeldt, the director of the TLA Cinema, is my guest. Al, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry. It's nice to be back on Fresh Air.
Before we talk a little bit about how you've approached finding movies for the theater and how the theater has changed, how South Street has changed, because you've been there for all of the South Street Renaissance, what's the current status of the theater? If you could just give us an update on that.
Well, in a word, the current situation is uncertain. It's not nearly as pessimistic as a lot of people believe. There was a considerable amount of publicity a month or so ago, which is entirely the result of press releases sent out by Stephen Starr, all of which were, the contents purported of which were printed in the newspapers without being verified. And many people believed what he said, that he was going to be in possession a month ago and renovating and having his first acts on stage this week, I believe. And he has been prevented in court from closing his agreement of sale. We're in a very complex legal struggle with the owners of the property, and we think we have a shot at staying. We have a program out right now that runs October and November, and we're planning another one, which will begin booking next week, to run beyond that.
Obviously, you don't want to see the theater closed.
Oh, no, I want to stay.
Okay. How did you start the TLAL?
Well, I started it... Actually, I was working for someone else at the time in New York, running a very small circuit of repertory cinemas there. And I first came to TLA to convert it from what had been a legitimate theater. It was been closed for about a year before I first saw it. And came here to convert it into a cinema and do the publicity on the first repertory program that we did. And it was a satellite for its first 4 months or so, 4 to 6 months. And that was very unsuccessful.
A satellite of what, this New York house?
A satellite of the New York operation. There were three houses up in New York. And it was believed by the person for whom I was working originally, who subsequently became my partner, and eventually I bought him out. But anyway, he believed that it could all be done long distance. That successful films that were shown up there could be simply moved down here, and we could run TLA by mail and telephone. It was a fallacious theory, and about 6 months later, I put my first program on the screen, and things began to turn around. One of the things about repertory cinema that's different from a conventional movie theater chain is that in the conventional situation, you put films on the screen and take them off, and they're usually current films, and if it's a hit, people go to see the film. They don't care what theater they're seeing it in. And if it's not a hit, people don't go to see it, and they don't care what theater is playing it. In the case of repertory cinema, because of the sheer volume of films that we show, the fact that some of them are fairly new and some of them are quite old, there's an awful lot of give and take between the cinema and its public. And the patrons have the opportunity to get a message across with regard to the kind of films that they want to see, the individual films they want to see, and the films that they don't want to see. And because of that sort of give and take, it was necessary that there be somebody here on premises, a resident director, taking the public pulse, getting to know the people who are coming to the theater, getting to know their tastes.
Because that shows that there's regional differences between what people want to see.
Oh, significant, yes.
What was South Street like when the TLA became a cinema in 1971?
South Street was very quiet. which would come as a surprise, I suppose, to many people who frequent South Street today. You could park a car anywhere on any block of South Street at any time of day or night. You would never run into a crowd. As a matter of fact, at night, the street was almost invariably deserted. And that was... That was the situation that we found. There were already some craft shops and galleries, there's a neighborhood coffee house. There's some very small places open to the public by people who could truly be called pioneers, who had come to a street that was under the axe in a way. South Street was slated to be demolished for Crosstown Expressway. That plan had been on the city books for about 10 years, and landlords had not improved their properties. The values had deteriorated, and a lot of people came in to an area where they a commercial area where they could deal with the public because they could afford the numbers, and they stayed and they struggled. Some left, some were replaced. But they determined the original flavor of the street. And there were about half full. I think there were about five people who are still operating in the community who were there before I arrived in 1971. And it was definitely an odd mix between old-fashioned businesses. I don't mean that in the pejorative sense. Dry goods places and so on.
Bridal shops,
lots of bridal shops, yes. And alternative culture shops.
It's funny because it still is that mix of that. There's still dry goods places and bridal shops, less so, but they're still there.
Yeah, I think the gap is being bridged as the street has become more successful, has become more commercial, more desirable place for people to go and do business. And so the distinction is not as sharp as it once was.
Did you foresee what was going to happen on South Street in terms of the economic boom, the Renaissance?
I foresaw that there would be a substantial development in the street. I certainly did not foresee what occurred. If anyone had said to me in 1971 that 7 or 8 years down the road, that very quiet street would be the busiest thoroughfare in Philadelphia during non-business hours, I would have doubted the person's sanity. But it's happened. There are more people on South Street, weekday evenings, all day Saturdays and Sundays and holidays, than any other part of the city.
How has that affected you? Has it made it easier or harder to operate? Because usually the more successful an area like that becomes, the more expensive it is to operate from it. Though, on the other hand, the more people show up. So I guess it has its pros and cons.
Yeah, it does have its pros and cons. It has brought a lot more people who become aware of the theater and who get our programs and having a lot of street traffic back and forth, thousands of people every day who can pick up a program, see what we're going to be showing, is helpful. On the other hand, yes, it has become a boom town, and I think if it hadn't, that the current legal struggle that we're in would not exist. But, you know, you take the good with the bad, no matter what you do.
The early 70s was a great time for the revival of theaters like the TLA. Movie theaters were becoming rock theaters and just almost community places for a interesting mix of events and films. What was the atmosphere like working in TLA at the time? The spirit amongst the people who worked there, the spirit amongst the people who came, has it changed much?
Oh yeah, it's changed. It's changed quite a lot. In the early days, things were kind of funky. The bulk of our staff came from a community. Many of the people in that community 9 years ago could be described as dropouts, people who just didn't want to hack it in a commercial world. Remember, it's still, you know, just still post 1968. A lot of people had gone through changes around that time, and a lot of the early customers that we got were very. Sympathetic with that sort of social attitude. And things have changed. The times have changed. people are not as funky as they were a decade ago. South Street itself has become more commercial. There are more tourists. The big visible difference on South Street is that there are more people coming there now because it has become a scene. Whereas in the early 70s, the people who went there to make the scene. And that was what dominated.
What's some of the fun parts and some of the harrowing parts for you of running a theater like the TLA?
Oh, well, the fun parts are devising programs, deciding what to show, what series of festivals to show, coming up with new programming ideas, new program formats, that sort of thing. The harrowing things are when the programs come back late from the printer, or when we have the whole thing laid out and a film distributor will call up at the last minute and cancel a number of bookings, and we have to tear it up and redo part of it, and not knowing, one of the harrowing things, of course, is the uncertainty, taking a chance on a particular program, on a particular festival, and not knowing whether it's going to be successful or not successful, because whenever we do anything at all ambitious, it involves a disproportionate amount of work and effort. We almost never expect to get a proportionate financial reward for doing something like that. It's done because it's interesting, because it makes the theater more interesting for us as well as for the public. And when things like that don't come through, it's kind of frustrating.
Frequently when you have a new schedule coming out, there's a few thematic aspects of the schedule, like a week of a certain French director or of a whole group of French directors or of films about war, films about a certain subject. How do you know what films you're going to have access to? Is there how do you know what's available? I imagine not everything's available every month.
No, it isn't. There are a lot of changes. The situation is somewhat more stable than it used to be, because one of the things that's happened throughout the 70s is that repertory cinemas have spread across the country. And the major distributors, the people who control the bulk of the films that are available to theaters around the United States, have become attuned to repertory cinemas as a market. They know they can make money. Consequently, they take the trouble to keep prints of films in service. It used to be that the majors would periodically junk their prints, almost all of their prints, of a fairly recent release, unless it was a blockbuster, and take one or two archive prints and store them in Los Angeles, at studio headquarters. That doesn't happen so much anymore. And as a result of booking over the years, I have a pretty good working knowledge of what's available and what's not most of the time. I unfortunately run across surprises here and there. Plan a whole series, around one or two key films and find out that the key films are going to be missing. And then it means scrapping a series or trying to redo it in some acceptable fashion.
When you're working with old films, you're not assured of getting a good print, though I'll tell you from going to new movies, I think you're not assured in a new cinema of getting a good print either, but it's more risky when you're dealing with old films.
No, ironically it isn't. Newer films that have been released since automation became standard in the motion picture
projection
industry.
Automation.
Projection, motion picture projection automation, yes. TLA, by the way, does not have automated equipment, and I brag about it. Automated equipment is notoriously bad on prints, physically bad. I don't know why it should be the case. You would think that the automated equipment could be designed to be very, very soft and gentle on the equipment. And I don't want to point fingers at whether it's the people who operate it or whether it's the way it's designed or the way the films get inspected. But my experience has been that since automated equipment, the quality of fairly recent releases has fallen off dramatically. And it's very difficult to explain to a patron that a film that was released 2 or 3 years ago has whole scenes missing, chunks of dialogue cut right out, scratches all over it, mucked up soundtrack, and that it's not our fault, that that's not the way we're projecting it, that it's not carelessness on our part, but that it's the condition of the print. I've seen it happen to new films. I've seen films be projected a couple of weeks and be destroyed. Whereas at TLA, we use the kind of equipment that's been around for a lot of years and is very reliable if you maintain the equipment and if you have people handling it who care about what they're doing. We do have people like that. We have very conscientious projections. We have had the experience of running films for a year, two, three, 4 years, as midnight shows, for example, or running print. For example, back in 1974, I ran King of Hearts at TLA for about 15 or 16 weeks. Same print, shown two, three times a day, 7 days a week, 15 or 16 weeks. I saw another print, fresh from the lab, be sent to two theaters, where it was shown a week at each theater, and come back as a bad print. A print that could not be run respectably in front of the public.
What does the distributor do when a print gets too mucky to be played anymore? Will they replace it?
No, they usually throw it away.
The
distributor will not replace a print unless the producer of the film authorizes its replacement. And very often, since the producers are going to make the bulk of their money, see, that's an expense that comes right off the top. The cost of new prints comes off the first monies received by the distributor. And if the producer is going to take that risk, the producer must know that there's more revenue in that particular film. With the advent of classics divisions by some of the major companies, notably United Artists, Columbia, Warner Brothers, this situation has begun to be corrected. I know a fellow who set up the Columbia Classics division recently, a division for which he fought tooth and nail for years. As a matter of fact, he was working for Columbia New York when I was working in New York a decade ago. And after years of fighting, he finally persuaded the company to set up a new division and persuaded them to strike new prints, which meant that they had to in turn to go out and persuade distributors, I mean producers, that it was worth investing money in these films and that eventually the reward would be there.
Do you have any ability to get your money back or to get anything in exchange if you're given a film that isn't good?
If it is disastrous and we have to give out a lot of refunds and there's a major problem with it, we can make some adjustment. But usually they say, oh, too bad, and they'll either junk the print, or if it's just one reel that's bad, they'll pull that reel and perhaps make up a composite print of a couple of bad ones, you know, and send that out.
Another problem in the industry that a lot of filmmakers and probably distributors are concerned about is the way that many color films have been fading. And I know this is a problem that you're aware of. I think Martin Scorsese is currently on a campaign to try to convince people in film technology to develop color that will keep over a long period of time. Now, as someone who runs a screening house, how does that issue affect you?
Well, surprisingly, it doesn't seem to bother the public as much as you would think. It bothers me a great deal. The difficulty is that Eastman Kodak, a company that has a lock on the market in the United States and in the world, they have a lock on color film, will invest a great deal of money research into home equipment because it is a reliable and high profit market. But they've done very little in the way of research to preserve the integrity of the color stock. For example, old Technicolor films. If you see an old Technicolor print, something could have been made in 1939, and you can see the print today, or you can see a print struck from the original negative. Beautiful. The color doesn't fade. Rich and lush, and just it's a trip just to watch it. But if you see things that were shot in Eastman color, for example, a lot of the a lot of the early new French New Wave films, films by Truffaut and Godard and Chabrol, that that people loved in the early 60s, if you look at those films now, you've no idea what the original color was. You just can't tell. I get very upset whenever I see that. And it's a discredit to the public. It is part, I think, of the disposable mentality that we've been confronted with in the past 10 or 15 years throughout society. You know, it's better to buy something, use it once or twice and throw it away, than to buy something or make something that will last for a long time. It used to be that that film was made to last. Now it isn't. Whether it's the home market or the theatrical market, the presumption is that people are going to have a short-term interest in it, and then that bothers. So why be concerned about how long the color lasts? And Scorsese's right. I hope he wins. I think that if he can generate enough support, and I know the support is out there, he might force Eastman to get off their cans and do something. They don't like bad publicity.
Maybe the repertory cinema movement, and it is a movement now because most major cities have at least one good repertory house that's constantly bringing back films that have gone out of their first release many years ago. Maybe the interest in repertory cinema will also help convince film distributors and Kodak that there will be a constant market for this stuff, and there's profits yet to be made, and that it's worthwhile to develop a good technology.
Well, you're right, and I don't think it would be very difficult to convince the producers or the distributors. They'd all be delighted. You have to go back to the producers. The distributors are going to distribute whatever is there. You know, it's a commodity to them. The producers would love to see the color process that would endure as long as it wouldn't cost them an arm and a leg to create that endurance.
Right. You know, it seems to me that like film and television and music, the record industry, are all discovering that their stuff is recyclable. It can be used. Television is constantly bringing back reruns. There's repertory cinemas. Record companies are doing reissues. That seems to come and go in popularity. A lot of reissue programs seem to have been cut back quite a bit. But there is that interest in keeping documents of the past available and accessible to the public.
Yeah, and you know it's very disturbing. You can go back to a lot of motion picture footage, whether it be feature films or newsreels, whatever, made in the 30s and 40s, largely black and white, even in the 50s. And they are as graphically immediate today as they were when they were shot. And most of them were shot before, you know, we talk about things that were shot before we were born. And yet, films shot in color, which should give us a more real representation of a real world that was shot in our lifetime, don't look anything like the real world because the real world doesn't consist of colors like that.
Right.
And it's really unfortunate.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Al Malmfeldt, the director of the TLA Cinema on South and 4th Streets, and we're talking about the TLA and what it's like to run a repertory cinema. You may have read reports that the TLA was scheduled to have been closed by now and that a club was supposed to have been there in its place, but the closing of TLA is no longer as imminent as it was. There's a new schedule out. The cinema so far is remaining open. Al, you have the cinema has been known not only for its repertory thematic series, but also for its more cult type showings at
sure.
midnight on Fridays
sure.
and Saturdays. And some of the films that I know that have been successful there have been The Harder They Come, Pink Flamingos, and most recently the Rocky Horror Show. Maybe you could compare for us the kinds of audiences that have showed up for those three films and the way they reacted to the screening once in. Certainly the most flamboyant audiences have shown up for the Rocky Horror Show.
First, let me go back to a distinction that we make in doing programming between midnight shows and regular programming. My thesis about programming a cinema for the public has always been within the bounds of reasonable quality to program for as wide a variety of people as possible. We go to the extreme of there's a very cerebral foreign films, to the other extreme of midnight shows that are going to attract essentially a young audience that has absolutely no cerebral interest whatsoever in what they're seeing, at least at that time. Our first midnight show actually was in 1971. We opened the theater. We started with midnight shows right away, and at that time we were showing Night of the Living Dead. We helped to establish midnight shows in Philadelphia. I believe TLA was the first theater in Philadelphia to run midnight shows on a regular basis. And we helped to establish Night of the Living Dead as a cult film in Philadelphia. It, as a matter of fact, it subsequently became a big drive-in item after we had run it quite a lot as a midnight show. But our big successes began with Pink Flamingos in 1973. We ran that for 2 years. And then we had The Harder They Come for a year, and it was in 1976 we began showing Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is still there. If I were to characterize the differences between the basic differences between the audiences of those three films, I would say that Pink Flamingos, because of its subject matter.
Which is what? You should tell us a little bit about the film.
Well, its subject matter is about different people who are struggling for the claim of the filthiest person in the world. The film is an intentional gross out. And as it ran on, and word about it spread, people would come down who wanted to be grossed out. Well, people who want to be grossed out tend themselves to be rather gross before they arrive. And this was an experience we'd never had at TLA before. And we would, we would find lots of fraternity jocks coming down with six packs of beer, having already evidently consumed quite a lot of beer and grass or whatever by the time they arrived at the TLA, and doing minor acts of vandalism to show that they were as gross as the characters and so on. And that became a bit of a drag. As a matter of fact, we stopped showing the film, not because it was unsuccessful. It really held a pretty steady level for about 2 years, but because we were really sick and tired of the kind of behavior that we were being confronted with. And when we showed The Harder They Come, we had a much more serious midnight audience. It wasn't quite as large as the one for Pink Flamingos, but there were a lot of people who were into the music. And they really just wanted to get off on the movie.
The music is reggae music.
Music was reggae music, and people enjoy the music, enjoy the film, enjoy coming to the theater, and we enjoy that. We didn't have any problems. Pink Flamingos is a case totally apart from anything else. It's really unprecedented in film history because of the phenomenon of audience participation.
You mean the Rocky Horror Show?
I'm sorry, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, yes. And that was something that no one ever anticipated happening. It hadn't happened when it was a stage hit in London for many years. It was a surprise to Richard O'Brien, who was the creator of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I remember having a chat with him a couple of years ago about the way the audiences reacted, and he was really questioning me. He said, "They really do that? They really say those things?" I said, "Oh, yes, yes." And it became, in a way, a kind of tourist attraction, because a lot of people would come, a lot of older people would come, to watch the performance of the people who were in the theater, throwing rice and yelling back and forth at the screen.
There was a stage show for quite a while before the movie started.
That's right. That's right. In the first year, year and a half that we had it, we had a coterie of regular performers who would act out different roles in the film. And they've since passed on to other things and from time to time been replaced by a different succession of performers. But there has been established a real Rocky Horror Picture Cult. It's nationwide. There's an organization. They have a publication. They have an annual convention. It goes on and on. And there's been a tremendous amount of energy and quite a few surprises and just a totally different situation with Rocky Horror. For one thing, we for the first time had a midnight show that was once we established it was consistently selling out for a very long time. And the situation was a little bit different in Philadelphia from what it was around the country. Philadelphia was one of the test markets for Rocky Horror when it was first released. There were several cities in the country in which it was simply opened as a new film in a downtown theater. It did very badly here, as it did in all the cities that it played in. And I had to fight with the distributor for months to get the film. And then had to fight for another 6 months to keep it, even though the grosses weren't what they had hoped. In the cities in which it had gone, it had opened as a midnight attraction, I think, only in New York and in Austin, Texas, for some reason, before we had it. And then it opened in several other cities. But in the cities where it had never shown as a regular attraction, had never been subjected to reviews, and the only word of mouth was the word of mouth of the people who were getting into the cult right away, it was doing much better than it was in Philadelphia. But after about 6 months of struggling and working out different promotional campaigns and assuring the distributor, wait, be patient, it's going to happen, within a month, it just exploded. And stayed that way for several years.
How did the audience interaction with the film evolve? I've always wondered if people say the same thing to the screen in every city. Have you traveled around seeing it in other cities?
I have not traveled around to that many cities, though I've read about it in other cities. I have seen it in New York. A great deal of the responses were New York originated. And people who had seen it in New York would start doing the same thing in Philadelphia. And then other people would pick up on it. And then they would invent some lines. And they would do certain things. They'd hear about rituals that were going on in other places, and they'd begin those rituals. And it began slowly feeding on itself. Now, there's some variation on the line. Sometimes someone will improvise. But it began piecemeal developing. And it took about a year before the piecemeal development settled into a ritual that you could predict from beginning to end of the film.
The night I saw it, the people who were acting outside of that ritual, who were just yelling what came into their head up at the screen, were booed by everybody
yes,
else.
Yeah,
You're
no.
not supposed to do that.
No. You're supposed to go along with the program.
Was there any unusual behavior that you had to, or that whoever had to control during the screenings? Any rowdiness or
occasionally. I mean, you simply can't get
excessive spilling of liquids or whatever.
You simply can't get 400 exuberant people into a public place without having a few crowd control problems. But that happens not just with Rocky Horror Picture Show. That happens with many things, and we're used to it. We had to take pains to begin screening people and stopping certain things from being brought into the theater, and running people through sort of a drill before they got inside the auditorium, so that the staff would be in control of what was going on rather than the audience. But that was just something to work out.
Mm-hmm. You want to keep a rapport with your audience, but also keep things cool.
Yeah. You can't. I mean, you can't either let people come in and take over a theater, or treat customers like cattle and give them a real hard time and push them around and be offensive and take their presence for granted. Some sort of median has to be found. There has to be a firm hand in the velvet glove, if you can pull it off.
You still showing Rocky Horror?
Oh yes.
How has the audience changed?
Well, as time has gone on, the initial sense of adventure and discovery, of course, passed. The audience participation has settled into a ritual, into a real pattern. Generations of performers have come and gone. And it has become, it's become a thing. It's almost an institution. It's not just another movie that's showing. It is, I mean, I don't want to equate it, let's say, with the Fantastics, you know, but it is something that has become obligatory to go and see, for the film and for the audience.
Let's talk a little bit about other types of thematic screenings that you have. I get the feeling sometimes that directors pass in and out of favor with audiences. Take someone like Godard, who will, I'm sure, always be recognized as a great director, but recently a lot of people are talking about Godard, whereas 4 or 5 years ago he seemed to be a little bit on the outs as far as a well-known, highly thought-of director.
Well, in the case of Godard, it's because he really dropped out. He dropped out politically and socially and cinematically. He was doing a lot of television stuff. He has a studio that he does a lot of his work, a lot of his experimental work in Grenoble. And he was not making feature films for the commercial theatrical market. And, you know, out of sight, out of mind.
So
because now he has a new film out, and everybody's right. paying attention to him. It was at the New York Film Festival last week. Vincent Canby wrote a rave review of it. He's been the subject of feature articles in major newspapers in different cities in the country. And now he's getting a lot of attention. He's being rediscovered.
What can you tell us about Philadelphia tastes in terms of which countries or which directors seem to catch on in the city?
In the main, I would say it's the bigger names. There is not as much adventurous exploration of cinematic territory in Philadelphia as there is in a few other cities in the country. Philadelphia, you must remember, is not what you would call an international city. The way that New York is an international city, or Boston, or Washington, or San Francisco. And having an international population in a major city provides a built-in audience for a lot of foreign films. That audience does not exist in any substantial way in Philadelphia. So someone like Godard, for example, would never be big in Philadelphia. Truffaut would be big. Fellini would be big. Bergman would be big. But it's the major names. Can't really show films by minor directors unless an individual film just happens to be something that gets a lot of attention and draw much of an audience.
Well, do you go to the commercial cinemas much? To the new first release cinemas?
Less and less every year.
You know, a lot of people are so disturbed about new trends in violence and sexual abuse. I wonder how you feel about that. You know, as someone who's been screening the Pink Flamingos and the Rocky Horror Show.
Well, Pink Flamingos and the Rocky Horror Picture Show are not taking the subject seriously. You know, first of all, Rocky Horror is not violent. I mean, there's one violence scene in the entire film.
No, but I could see people going in and saying, oh, gosh, the 13-year-olds of the city are watching transsexual vampires or whatever, you know, transsexual beasts.
All I can say is you ought to have a social discussion with 13-year-olds.
When I was there, I really wanted to. I didn't, of course. I felt a little bit like a sociologist there that night. But I was really wondering, like, how... what the 13-year-olds understood about transsexuality or about...
A great deal.
Really. And also, I should say, one of the things that really got me thinking about that is that a few of the kids who were in the performance seemed pretty young, maybe 15 or 16, and were dressed up in, like, you know, black stockings and garter belts, very, S&M kind of attire, really.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder, well, gee, what do they know about this? Are they being ironic about it, like the movie's being ironic? I really couldn't tell what was happening.
Well, some of them are being ironic, but truthfully, some of them are being quite serious. There is a big difference between young people today and young people 10 or more years ago. There are always changes. And, you know, the current generation is not the first one to think that it discovered sex at the age of puberty. That's something that we've all gone through. And we all think we're breaking new ground, which we aren't. But there is a greater awareness of sexuality, of sexual innuendo, of sexual relationships among kids today who are puberty, pre-puberty even, or slightly older than I remember ever before.
One of the things I thought was kind of funny was watching people who had probably just gone through puberty having this very world-weary attitude, you know, expressed on stage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's ironic. It's ironic.
It's funny. I almost think that I should just backtrack a little bit. And what I know, some people will misunderstand what I said about 3 minutes ago when I used when I was talking about transsexuals and transsexual vampire. I can't remember what.
Well, you were talking about new trends in film.
No. I just want to say that it wasn't meant as a slur. I was just referring to the films and kind of the really odd way that everybody's treated within the movie. So do you have any feelings about the trends in first releases now? Are you disturbed about violence?
No.
Do you treat it with a certain amount of distance and irony, even if the film doesn't?
That's how I would put it. I have seen too many trends come and go. And there has been a trend in the last few years, very violence-oriented, very, very shock, horror-oriented. You know, whether it's from kung fu to exorcism, they're pretty predictable. The characters and the plots are pretty much interchangeable, and they're all cashing in on a wave of popularity. That's what people are going out to downtown theaters to see, and that's what's being made. And it shouldn't be surprising. I think it'll pass on. I don't know what will replace it. But it's not the sort of thing that's going to endure anyway. The individual films won't endure. There's almost nothing in the genres that we're talking about that have become very popular in the last few years.
You know what I can think of? The Sergio Leone series, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More. Those were, pretty violent, sadistic types of westerns, but they're always coming back at the repertory cinemas, and some people view them, you know, very seriously as a kind of special example of that type of genre.
Well, I take Leone pretty seriously. I don't take him as seriously as I take Godard or Truffaut or Fellini, but I take Leone seriously. Once Upon a Time in the West is really a very well put together film, very interesting.
So you think chances are that in the genres that a lot of people are basically writing off now as being a really horrible flash in the pan, that there will be people working within those genres whose work will endure for one reason or another?
Well, the only person that I can think, there are a couple of people who are being discussed seriously in film magazines, for example, Brian De Palma, John Carpenter. Whether or not their work will endure, I don't want to speculate. I think that it's always very difficult at the time that something is going on to gauge how it will be viewed some years hence. Mm-hmm. You never know. But De Palma has elicited a lot of interest for quite a number of years now.
I actually consider him to be outside of that genre because.
But he's cashing in on it.
They're not fast, cheap films.
That's true,
like,
but because of the genre and because of its popularity, Brian De Palma is able to go out and make his films. He doesn't have to run a lot of roadblocks in order to get his projects on screen. So it's, I suppose, in that sense, life is very convenient for Brian De Palma. There are probably, for every Brian De Palma, there's probably 100 or 1,000 directors who have projects that don't fit into what is commercially desirable these days, who have to run roadblocks for years to get one film launched, and De Palma can go out and just knock one out every year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate, not because De Palma's getting to make films, because other people aren't.
Well, time's gone very quickly, and we're really just about out of time, but tell us what's happening in the next few weeks at the TLA, some of the special things you have planned.
We've just concluded a tribute to Peter Sellers. We have coming up a variety of repertory films. We've got children's films on Saturday afternoons, and we've got a cultural series on Sunday afternoons, in which we're going to be showing Joseph Losey's Don Giovanni, his Mozart film. We'll be showing Irene Pappas in Iphigenia. We'll be showing Chagall. We also have a gay film festival coming up that will run for about 9 days. That comes up next week. And then beginning on November 10th, we have a Fassbinder Festival, which is the first major Fassbinder Festival that's been done in Philadelphia. We have 10 of his films. You know, Fassbinder is, of course, one of the most prominent of the new German filmmakers.
One of the most prolific.
And he is the most prolific director working in the world today. He had made 30 films by the time he was 30. He's slowed down a little bit now. He only makes one every year or two. But we have 10 films. They cover a period of about 10 or so years in his career. They're all typically Fassbinder, but they differ from each other in very significant ways. And I think it's going to be a really interesting, exciting festival. We had a Herzog Fest. We had to show the films of Werner Herzog back in the spring, and it was an extremely popular festival, and many people who came to every single program in the series, and we're hoping that the same sort of interest and enthusiasm will exist for Fassbinder.
Well, Al, I want to thank you very much for being here, and I should mention if anyone wants some more detailed rundown of the screenings, there are schedules available at the TLA, which is on South and 4th Streets. And I've been with Al Malmfeldt, who is the director of the TLA, and he's been running the cinema since it started in 1971. You may have been reading that the cinema was going to close and that a nightclub was going to open in its stead, and that was actually scheduled to happen at just about this time. Well, the closing of the TLA is no longer as imminent as it was. You may have heard that there was a coalition of people from the South Street area who were protesting the liquor license that was requested that would be needed in order to turn it into a club. There's also some litigation in process now. So everything remains to be seen. Things are kind of up in the air now. But the TLA continues, and your schedule runs until...
The current schedule runs until November 30th, and we are working on another one. If anyone would like a copy, they can call TLA, and we'll happily mail them one right away, and they can do that by calling 922-6011.
Great. Well, Al, thanks a lot for being here. It's been really interesting to talk with you.
Terry, thank you very much for having me back.
Al Malmfeldt is the director of the TLA. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.